The fight for civil rights may seem like a chapter in the history books, but all across the South, there are living, breathing stories of incredible courage and extraordinary resilience in the face of ongoing injustice. Welcome to Southern Gumption. I'm your host, Andy Lee, and together we'll embark on a journey through history and the present day to reveal the unheard voices who have been instrumental in shaping the fight for voting rights, justice system reform, and environmental justice. Southern Coalition for Social Justice does work within its three focus areas: voting rights, environmental justice, and justice system reform. But there are issues that sit within the intersection of those focus areas, where the worlds of two intricate systems meet, and everyday Southerners get caught in between. In these intersectional episodes, we're going to have straightforward conversations with experts and frontline advocates, explaining and exploring a topic that sits between two of SCSJ's focus areas. In this episode, we'll be talking about prison gerrymandering and how incarcerated people are used to distort political representation. I'm joined by Mike Wessler, the Communications Director for the Prison Policy Initiative. So can you tell me a little bit about what the Prison Policy Initiative does as a whole?
Yeah, absolutely. We are a research organization that conducts research on the harms of mass incarceration. We think, like a lot of folks, that the country has taken part in a 40-year failed experiment with mass incarceration, where states and the federal government have locked up more and more people over the last few decades. And it hasn't made our communities safer. And in fact, it has kind of torn apart our communities and severely damaged communities, particularly Black and Brown communities. We do research to show how mass incarceration is failing the residents of the country. And we try to do it in a way that is understandable for folks, because we know that, you know, sometimes this stuff can be a bit overwhelming and hard to comprehend. And we also know that prisons and jails don't want people to know about this information. Right. They try to operate as black boxes. So we try to kind of put the information in the spotlight, so to speak, so it's readily accessible to advocates, to journalists who want to cover the criminal legal system, and to policymakers who want to introduce legislation that will make the system smaller and more just.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of making complicated topics a little bit more understandable, when we are talking about prison gerrymandering, I feel like I have a pretty bad sense as someone who works within this sort of like reform social justice space of, oh, I think people would understand the term prison gerrymandering, when I think in actuality, the average person would hear that term and their mind would go blank. How would you define it to someone who had never heard of it before?
Yeah. So a few things. Prison gerrymandering, first and foremost, is about representation. It's about how loud of a voice we all get in our government. In principle, we're all supposed to have the same voice in government. But what's happened is the Census Bureau counts incarcerated people every 10 years when it does its count in the wrong place. It counts them as residents of a prison cell, even though rather than in their home communities, the place that they came from, the place that they call home, the place that they have social ties, the place that they'll likely return to, and the place that most state laws say remains their home, even while they're incarcerated. Now, the Census Bureau has done this since the beginning of time. It wasn't really an issue until the U.S. undertook this failed experiment with mass incarceration, where it was locking up more and more people. And what ended up happening is when the Census Bureau was counting these people in prisons and those numbers ballooned, we were seeing the populations of these really rural communities that previously had really small populations suddenly massively grow in size. So they'd grow 2-3 times as big as they were just the decade prior. Now, where this becomes a problem is states use that census data to draw state legislative lines, congressional lines, and city and county commissioners do it as well to draw their district lines. And what it ends up doing is it gives those people who live closest to prisons a louder voice in government by artificially inflating the population of those areas. Each of those legislative districts that they draw is supposed to have the same number of people. But those districts that have prisons have thousands of people sometimes who aren't really residents of those areas. They don't know their lawmakers. They're not reaching out to their lawmakers to try to solve their problems. They have no ties. They don't understand the issues of those areas, but they're counted as residents there. So that gives people who live close to the prisons a louder voice to get their problems solved. Yeah, you know, if they really feel strongly about an issue, they can reach out to their lawmakers, and those lawmakers have fewer constituents to actually answer to. So it's giving a small group of people who live close to prisons a louder voice at the expense of everyone else throughout the state who doesn't live near a prison, particularly those communities that are highly incarcerated, communities of color, poorer communities. It's kind of silencing their voice and giving it to other folks simply because they live close to prisons.
Mm-hmm. What is the reasoning, or is there any kind of like straight answer from decision makers about one versus the other? Or is it just, this is how we've always done it?
I think it's a little bit of this is how we've always done it, which is, you know, a powerful argument. I think if people don't understand how something will change, they're resistant to change. So they try to stick with it. Now, I think the other thing that's interesting is a lot of times it's just something that hasn't occurred to folks that they can do differently.
Right.
And what's been interesting as we worked on prison gerrymandering for 20 years at the Prison Policy Initiative when no one had heard the term. We were trying to kind of get it into the public consciousness. And where we first really saw communities recognizing this was a problem was actually in some of those rural districts or rural cities and counties that had prisons. They were trying to draw their city and county commission lines, but the prisons were dramatically distorting what those district lines would look like. So the best example is, like, let's say you had a city that had 5,000 people in it, and it had five city council districts in there, but you had a prison that had 900 people in it. That prison would go into one of those city council districts, and so would 100 residents also that are actual residents of that area. Those 100 residents would have as loud of a voice as 1,000 residents in any of the other city commission districts. So there's a place called Anamosa, Iowa, where this was so extreme that they actually didn't have somebody running for their city council. The person who won ended up winning because two people wrote his name in. And that was the district that had the prison. And the person was like, this isn't right. This isn't how it's supposed to work. This isn't how government's supposed to work. So I think that's a powerful piece of evidence that it's not really about the normal partisan and political posturing that often defines redistricting and those sorts of things. A lot of it's about just this, they've not even realized this was a problem or that it was a problem they could do anything about. Mm-hmm. Now, the nice thing is we've seen as awareness has grown about prison gerrymandering and that the problem can be solved, we've seen some pretty considerable bipartisan support for fixing it. You know, there's a lot of over 200 rural cities and counties across the country that we know of that have fixed the problem. Now, these communities all have prisons in them. Those communities often tend to be more conservative. So they've recognized this as a problem. We've also had states like Montana, not a blue bastion, used to be purple. It's pretty deep red now. It's got a Republican supermajority in the legislature.
Right.
It's got a Republican governor. And they just last year, they passed legislation near unanimously to fix this problem. And the governor signed it. Republican members of their redistricting commission have called on the Census Bureau to change how it counts incarcerated people. So there isn't a lot of opposition to it. I think you sometimes hear folks worry about the impact that ending prison gerrymandering will have on funding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we often, every 10 years, with really good intention, folks encourage people to fill out the census form because it'll bring dollars back to your community. And it will, but it's not on a direct one-to-one basis.
Right.
You know, your community doesn't receive a certain number of dollars just because you filled out the form. There's a whole series of mechanisms that the federal government uses to determine how much money goes to a community based on things like need, based on demographics, things of that nature. And prison populations don't really impact those funding mechanisms because they don't, people who are in prison don't get assessed for the need of a program because they're not eligible for that program. Mm-hmm. So we hear communities are in states are worried that it'll impact their federal funding, and it just won't. So I think once we kind of help to explain that, a lot of the opposition dries up. So I think it's really about inertia, getting folks to recognize this is a problem that doesn't have to exist, that it can change, and ultimately trying to get the Census Bureau to change its policy as well. And, you know, anyone who's ever tried to change a federal policy knows that it takes time and the federal government moves slow. We've been working at it for 20 years now, as I said, so we feel pretty good about the chance that the Census Bureau is going to finally fix this for the 2030 census count, but we're not taking anything for granted.
It's also important to note that many people in jail or prison can still vote, depending on your state's laws. Most people who are incarcerated either haven't been convicted or have just been convicted of a misdemeanor. In North Carolina, for example, those people are still eligible to vote and can do so with an absentee ballot. How does North Carolina stack up against the rest of the nation?
Yeah, so right now, a little over a dozen states have addressed prison gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. Those are, like I said, deep blue states like California, deep red states like Montana, and purple states like Maine and Pennsylvania. North Carolina is not among that list, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. We have seen some efforts, thanks to folks at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice and other groups, to try to get the state to introduce legislation to change it at the state level. That hasn't gotten traction yet. We're still hopeful. We think there's a really good chance that North Carolina could address this problem. Congresswoman Deborah Ross from North Carolina has introduced legislation in Congress to force the Census Bureau to change its policy, to force the Census Bureau to count incarcerated people in their home communities mm-hmm. rather than at the prison cells. You know, Congress is having trouble paying its light bills right now. So we are thrilled that Congresswoman Ross introduced this bill, and we're hopeful that it will get traction. You know, stranger things have happened in Congress, but we're also realistic that we don't expect it to get a ton of traction in this current environment. But we think the fact that Congresswoman Ross demonstrated that leadership to introduce this bill and brought on co-sponsors from across the country sends a message, even if the bill doesn't pass, to the Census Bureau to say, like, we want this changed. Like, we're adding our voice to the chorus of people who want this changed. So there's leadership at the national level from North Carolina. And then there are some communities in North Carolina, Columbus County in particular is one that comes to mind, that has said prison gerrymandering is not happening here. So in their local districts, I don't have the numbers in front of me, unfortunately, for Columbus, mm-hmm. But in their local districts, they've said, like, we're not going to count incarcerated people as residents of the prison cell. We're going to have draw fair districts for our local lines. And, you know, it's often easy to ignore local government in a lot of the decision making and a lot of the public policy that takes place. But a lot of really important public policy takes place at the local level. And right. A lot of the most distortive impacts of prison gerrymandering happen at the local level. And what I mean by that is, you know, an average North Carolina House district has about 87,000 people in it. So if you put a prison in with 3,000 people in there, it certainly has an impact on distorting the makeup of that district. But mm-hmm. a county commission district is much smaller. So a 3,000 person prison can dramatically distort a county commission district. So it's where we see the most distortive impacts of prison gerrymandering, and it's where certain people can have their voices elevated the loudest.
When states or when governmental bodies end prison gerrymandering, does it affect the sort of urban or more racially diverse districts that these incarcerated individuals may originate from or list as their home addresses by diluting their vote at all?
So when a place addresses prison gerrymandering, now it's important to remember, let me take a step back actually, that the demographics are different throughout the country. You know, in southern states, a lot of communities that contain prisons also have a lot of Black and brown residents that live nearby, whereas in urban areas or in more urban states, northern states, prisons tend to be in rural areas that tend to be whiter. So there's no universality in this. But here's kind of speaking with broad strokes. We know that Black people are disproportionately incarcerated in this country at the rate, I think it's 6 times higher than white residents. So that means that those Black communities are losing some of their voice to prison gerrymandering currently. And the places who are benefiting are largely white communities that contain prisons. When a state ends prison gerrymandering, the biggest impact is that those communities that contain prisons that often are more white, they lose that extra voice in government and it gets returned to where it came from. So those communities that are highly incarcerated, they do get their voice back. Now, that is really important. And obviously, one of the central kind of reasons for addressing prison gerrymandering. But one of the core dynamics to remember about prison gerrymandering is it's really the districts that contain prisons are benefiting at the expense of everyone else. And they benefit big time. In certain areas, they'll have multiple times louder voices in government than people who don't live near prison. So addressing prison gerrymandering mostly just brings the voice of those people who live near prisons back in line with everyone else and gives those who live further away kind of their voices back. You know, it's about the notion of voting and the role of prison gerrymandering. Because I think there's a lot of folks who think like people in prison, they generally can't vote. So what does this matter? Or they turn to an argument about whether or not people in prison can vote as to how it ties into prison gerrymandering. And obviously voting is one way that we interact with our government. But it's not the only way. So I think it's important to like recognize that prison gerrymandering is more about political representation than just voting. Because we can all reach out to our congresspeople, our legislators, our city or council officials, and ask them to take action at any time. We don't have to wait for election season to do it. So I think it's important to recognize that prison gerrymandering is really about political representation in the broadest sense, and making sure that people have an equal say in their government at all times, not just at the ballot box.
It is interesting that like any kind of discussion around sort of electoral systems, it feels like the conversation is just like built on top of Election Day. And that's not always the case. And that certainly isn't the case with prison gerrymandering.
Absolutely. Like as residents, we have lots of abilities to interact and a lot of roles that we can play. I think in some ways we've been trained to only pay attention on Election Day and then like ignore it and just trust that others will do the right thing. Now, I think history, both modern history in the last few years and in the long scope of hundreds of years, has taught us that that usually doesn't work out that well. I think folks should take a broader view of their representation and their role in government and engage constantly to make sure that they're government officials are taking action on their behalf. So we try to like broaden how people think about their role in government and how they're represented beyond just elections.
What are some things or avenues that individuals can take to advocate for change?
I think there's a couple of different levels of action that folks can take. The first, like in most circumstances, acting locally is where you can have the biggest impact.
Right.
You know, like I said, city and county governments, they have redistricting processes as well. It often goes on the city council agenda, one meeting, they introduce maps and it gets approved the next. There's not a lot of fanfare about it. Some cities and counties have had the same districts for 40 or 50 years, even as they've built new prisons in there. And they've just never re-examined those district lines. So they're all out of whack. So if somebody lives in a city or county that has a prison, the first thing they can do is reach out to their city council person or county council person and say, hey, when's the last time we did redistricting here? And how did we treat the prison? And explaining the issue to them. And we've seen a lot of folks who just, like I said, one of the biggest obstacles we face is folks just don't realize that there's something they can do about it. So simply raising the issue with city and county officials can sometimes gain traction. And, you know, state legislatures, they do their redistricting cycle usually right after new census data comes out. But cities and counties, they do it on all sorts of schedules. It kind of goes on all the time. There's somewhere that's redistricting. So reaching out to local city and county officials is a good place to start. Obviously, reaching out to your state lawmaker, asking them to either introduce a bill to address prison gerrymandering, or if there is a bill introduced, support that bill. Now, like I said, we're realistic about North Carolina's legislative makeup, and we know that it's a steep hill to climb, but we think it's doing so can make some movement. I think similarly, reaching out to congresspeople, asking them to support Representative Ross's bill. And then I think a place that most people wouldn't think about is the Census Bureau directly reaching out to them and saying, you need to change this policy. They have periodic public comment periods where they ask for public opinion on, you know, a certain issue. We anticipate in early 2025, the Census Bureau is going to do its first public comment period about its plans for 2030, where it says, this is how we think we're going to do this count in 2030. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you think about it. We're really hopeful that the Census Bureau is going to say, like, we've heard you. You know, half the country now lives in a place that's addressed prison gerrymandering. We've heard you for 20 years. We're going to solve this problem finally. We're really hopeful about that. And if they do that, I hope folks will reach out to the Census Bureau and say, thank you for doing it. It's the right thing. Don't change it. If they don't, I hope that folks light up the Census Bureau's phone lines, light up their email, and says, like, what the heck are you guys doing? You're not paying attention to what's happening out in the country. Like, red and blue states have tackled this. Rural communities have tackled this. The only people standing in the way at this point really is the Census Bureau. And reaching out and kind of letting them hear from residents directly can go a long, long way. We know that before the 2020 census, we had hoped that they would finally make this change. They didn't. They did take some half measures, largely in response to public pressure that they received. They made it slightly easier for state and local governments to address prison gerrymandering if they wanted to, using census data. We think that was a good step, but it certainly wasn't the full thing needed to be done. Like, the Census Bureau created this problem. It's not good enough for them to give state and local governments the tools to fix the Census Bureau's mess up. The Census Bureau needs to fix it. So I think in 2025, it's going to feel really early for people to think about the 2030 census. But really, the Census Bureau is laying the groundwork on some rules that will significantly impact how that census count is carried out, and ultimately how the redistricting process plays out in 2031 and 2032. So I hope folks will pay attention. And like I said, light up Census Bureau phone lines if they don't do the right thing, and send gracious thanking notes if they do the right thing.
I was about to say, I feel like most people, any point in time before the census form arrives at their house, is probably early for them to be thinking about the census. But 100%. For people like us, it's like 5 years before that, go.
Yeah. So our challenge is like making everyone else understand the urgency that like these decisions are being made now. Like, and if we don't think about it until 2030, we're too late. We've already lost and we got to wait another 10 years. Mm-hmm. So engaging early, paying attention to what the Bureau is doing now, and putting pressure on them to change their policy, because there is no law that says the Census Bureau has to count incarcerated people. It's just the way it's always been done, and they can easily change it. And there's a pretty convincing body of evidence now as to why they should. It's just a matter of getting them to finally take that step.
Thank you for listening to Southern Gumption. If you like this episode, please leave us a review and share it with your friends. Make sure to hit the subscribe so you don't miss out on an episode. You can find more information on Prison Policy Initiative's website or at their Prison Gerrymandering Project, Prisoners of the Census. You can check out the Prison Gerrymandering Toolkit SCSJ and the Prison Policy Initiative created at southerncoalition.org. Find us on Twitter at SCSJ or Instagram at SCSJOfficial. I'm Andy Lee, and this has been Southern Gumption. For the South, by the South.